If we continue to drain inventories, crude inventories, that is, and we hit a point where the market just doesn't have any excess, then people are really going to have to start bid up that incremental barrel that's out there. And that's where things can get really interesting, because price can move up very fast given where we are on the paper markets percentile. And then as we go up there, what's going to happen? Is OPEC Plus really going to react fast enough?
Tram, how you doing, man?
Good. Good. It's a nice beginning to 2024. I think definitely the same lull from 2023 is sort of continuing in terms of the oil markets, but we're seeing some differing theses come to fruition as we go on in terms of the U.S. shale outlook, and then some of the global oil demand continues to rise. So I think we're still on the same thesis, just preaching more patience here as time goes on. So it's been a good start to the year. Definitely some setbacks here and some green shoots as well. So I think the oil markets, as they are, very interesting, very volatile, and we'll see how the year goes here.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Let's revisit some theses. What are yours going into 2024?
Yeah, you bet. So I think the oil bull cycle throughout the last couple of years has been based on a structural supply, undersupply in the markets. And I think a large part of that was based on the U.S. shale no longer being the growth regime that it once was. But of course, 2022, again, it had come out very, very strong. The rig counts had risen quite a bit in 2022. And then 2023, again, we saw a big ramp up from the privates and the private producers, and them adding a lot of barrels there, and the lowering of the rig count not making an impact until kind of the second half / maybe even the fourth quarter of last year, and really a prolific increase that continues out of the Permian going forward. And we saw a big increase out of the Bakken. We saw a big increase out of the Eagle Ford and the Gulf of Mexico. So really, the U.S. Overall production thesis has not quite materialized as we thought it would. But going into 2024, now we have a higher base on that production, higher decline rates, and of course, continual well productivity degradation that's continuing. So we're seeing that on the one side. On the other side, we're seeing demand continue to rise at above average rates. So 2023, again, led by the Southeast Asian / Chinese resumption of international flights, along with the industry and just overall global resumption from where it was pre-COVID. In the 2024, I think we're going to see similar trends. We're seeing some visa waivers being put out by China and Malaysia and India. So we're seeing continued push for increased travel, increased demand in this higher interest rate environment, leading to higher petroleum consumption going forward. So really of the undersupply on one side, that's maybe not quite materialized. So extra supply that's come on the market. But of course, that trend doesn't necessarily mean it's going to continue on in this fashion going forward. Whereas demand does seem to continue on this fashion going forward in the straight trend line. So at what point does that become a clash? And of course, at what point does OPEC begin to add more barrels to the market? So really we're stuck in a tight range. That range can go upward, but of course we have the pressure that as that range goes upward, OPEC Plus is going to add those barrels back on the market. So we have a little bit of a flex cushion there moving forward. So really a market that's stabilized right now and at a price where we see we're at the 2 or 3 percentile on the global net longs on WTI plus Brent paper markets. So really very little room there for it to move downward. And really the push would be for it to move upward. But then again, as it moves upward, we're going to see OPEC plus add barrels onto the physical market, which then again brings that price down, really stabilizes it at a certain point in time. So it's really a supply-driven cycle. We've been pretty bang on demand and where global oil demand is going, but the global oil supply has been a lot higher than anticipated as well. So really cushioning some of that undersupply thesis going forward. So both of these factors, we're continually clashing here. And global oil demand continues to go up. So every year we see that million/1.5 million barrels per day of demand continue to rise, despite all the EVs and renewables and the changeover to electricity, some of the shutdowns in industry in Europe. We still see that 1.5 million barrels per day of increase per year, and global supply can only add so many barrels in a sub-$80 oil environment. So it has taken the brunt of that over the last couple of years. But going forward, again, we need that supply every single year. And at what point does that become an undersupply? Meanwhile, inventories are very low. So we don't have that safety net anymore that we had maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, such that as we go into this undersupply, while now we no longer need to drain this excess, it's already been drained with the undersupply that's taken place over the last 4 to 5 years. So really, once we get to that point, we're going to see this undersupply really make a huge impact, because we're getting down to operational minimums. We're getting down to the lowest oil possible in these systems. And that's what creates a physical undersupply. And that's what creates people going out and bidding out the barrel, which makes us a lot of money once we get there.
Right. You know, you brought up obviously a lot of stuff right there. I have a thesis, and I was asked this question by a trader, an investor that runs a really big fund, and he's in the metals industry. And he was just, this is about 4 weeks ago. He's like, Andy, why is oil where it's at? He was expecting it to be so much higher. And let me give you a thesis. It could be massive deflation in China that we're just not aware of, even though their consumption is still relatively good. Another one is program trades. So then you just have a bunch of program trades bots hitting the price of oil down. And then number three, it's an election year. It's hard. Who's going to get elected? Nobody's going to get elected, reelected, I should say, at $80, $90, $100 a barrel. So what are your thoughts on that, what I just said? Is that valid, or does that sound reasonable to you about where supply, the reason why the price of oil is still in the mid 70s, if you would, as we speak right now?
Yeah, 100%. So I think all good points, all playing a various factor into why oil price is where it is. I think one of the big factors has been, well, yes, we're in an election year, so the mandate is of the current government to reduce the price of gasoline. That's your billboard of inflation on every single street corner. They don't want that to go up. We've seen crack spreads actually come down quite a bit compared to where they were last year. So we're already seeing a normalization of where the gasoline prices versus where crude prices. But of course, people don't really notice these things as much. They just want lower price. They don't see that, hey, everything else has gone up 40%, whereas gas has only gone up 10%. They just see lower gasoline as a bare minimum requirement for voting, to some sense, for the incumbent electoral vote. So that's definitely a big factor. But I think really the biggest factor is nobody is willing to speculate on the price of oil. So in a 0% interest rate environment, people were going and making bets. They were saying, okay, well, we see that the price of oil could possibly be higher, and we can take money at X percentage interest, and we're willing to go and take on that positive bet on the price of oil and move it forward. But for the last 6 months to 12 months, we saw this happen in May, we saw this happen in September, and then we saw the big jump that happened up to $94 a barrel there in September, October, and then we saw the, again, deflation back to this sort of $70 to $80 range. Is really, the paper markets are unwilling to make a bet. So we sit at a 2% on the global net longs on WTI plus Brent over the last 20 years, and that's where we're going to be. Nobody is willing to take on a long contract at 10, 12, 14% interest and go and make a bet that, hey, oil price is going to be higher later, because they're just saying, hey, if we're paying that much interest anyway, over that 1 year period, we'll just wait. We'll see if the price is higher on the physical market, and then we'll buy the physical barrel at possibly a higher price. And especially in a backwardated market, it just makes sense to wait and see what comes up once that time is here to buy that physical barrel. So really, It's a lack of speculation. It's a lack of that net positive paper market. It's not even that we sit at 50%, 50 percentile and that people are unwilling to speculate. It's they're literally sold all the longs and have added some shorts even. Not all the longs. They've sold a lot of long contracts and they've added on a bunch of short contracts because there just is no appetite to go and use this much high interest rate paper to go and bid on that barrel. So we sit at historic lows and we're going to stay here until the fiscal market gets tight enough that people will have to go and bid up that barrel, or the paper markets have a need to go and sort of bid up that barrel. So what's it going to take? Well, it's going to take a real undersupply. So it's going to take crude fiscally drawing for many, many weeks at a million barrel plus per day undersupply. It's going to take the understanding that U.S. shale is no longer going to grow. It might even take some understanding of a permanent geopolitical risk. So right now we have geopolitical risk that's unknown. There's headlines coming out every day and then rescinded, causing huge swings in the crude market. Well, if there's a permanent geopolitical risk that is known, that's then when the speculators feel, okay, well, now we feel comfortable enough that we can make a bet on this and sort of stick with it for 6, 12, 18 months and stay with that contract. So either of those three, and really it's the physical undersupply that's going to be the main key point here. If we continue to drain inventories, crude inventories that is, and we hit a point where the market just doesn't have any excess, then people are really going to have to start bid up that incremental barrel that's out there. And that's where things can get really interesting, because price can move up very fast given where we are on the paper markets percentile. And then as we go up there, what's going to happen? Is OPEC Plus really going to react fast enough? You know, we think they are, but they've been delayed. In 2022, they were late in terms of not adding barrels and sort of stopping that resumption of the cuts. In 2023, they were late in terms of adding those cuts back. And, you know, one could say those were critical mistakes that were made at that period of time. And then once again, once you decide to add more barrels to the market, well, the global oil and water has to absorb a lot of barrels to take into account the increased export that's being taken there. So an extra 10, 20, 30 million barrels is to end up on the oil and water before that oil ends up in sort of your global marketed crude stream. And that's a process. There's a 2, 3, 4 month process to add those barrels back. And what happens to the markets in the meantime? How much are speculators willing to push this up? And how tight does a physical market really get? For example, for the last 2 weeks, and this is talking about Vortexa data, we have drawn about 2.5 almost million barrels per day of crude for the last 14 days. So that's a huge number we're talking about. We're talking about 35 to 40 million barrels now over the last 2 weeks. And that's a pretty big number that we're drawing and continuing to draw. So it'll be interesting to see what data comes out here on Monday for the current week. But if that trend continues, we're going to talk about pretty low inventories here moving forward with no excess in the very near future. So it's going to be a very interesting time going forward. What is required for the paper barrel to come on and support the price? Because it doesn't take very much. And once those paper barrels start getting added, we could move up $10, $15, $20 in a very, very fast period of time. As we saw when the Israel-Hamas incident happened, that price went from 72 to 94 in the blink of an eye. And we still only were at about 48 to 50 percentile on net longs. So what happens if we hit 70, 80, 90 percentile of net longs? Well, there's a big push there for that paper market to push that price up into higher regimes. And again, the oil market is not a fast moving market. So even if the price goes there, that doesn't mean supply just gets added overnight. There's going to be a decision that needs to be made, and then the barrel gets added, and then it ends up in the crude stream 2, 3, 4 months down the road. And that's where a lot of money can be made during that period. And of course, it leads to a more stronger bullish cycle going forward either way.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you said that, because I see, and I'm not making a prediction here, but I see this is really set up for a really strong short squeeze. Similar. Not that there is a short squeeze in uranium, but last June, and when we first spoke, uranium just shot up straight up for 6 months. And I can see a really, really strong short squeeze because of inventory, because of the paper markets, and because of all these people that are short. They got to cover, and inventories being so low. So what is going to be the catalyst to that? You know, who knows? It could be, you mentioned geopolitical. It could be just an understanding that shale is not going to replenish like it was. It could be just an understanding that we don't have the supply that is perceived, or just, you know, we no longer have supply or necessary supply. You know, who knows what that is? But yeah, it sounds like you see the same thing. There's a potential for a really violent high move up in crude. So, how would you play this if you would? You're obviously looking at the smaller caps, some of the juniors and that sort of thing. And I've just told people, you know, this is the time to be a buyer, just to set yourself up for the move that's going to happen sooner or later. How would you play this?
Yeah, so very, very interesting question. I think one that has been on top of mind for the last 2 years. People who have stuck to the blue chip companies have definitely done a lot better in the last 18 months, let's call it. They've really stuck to these high quality names that are stable, and they put out a stable cash flow. They have these dividends, they have buybacks, and they're really supporting their own share price. And it's still trading at relatively decent cash flow multiples. But really, what's happened in the meantime is the mid caps and the juniors have gotten even more hit. So there was already maybe a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 gap between the blue chips and the mid caps. Well, now the gap is maybe 4-to-1 or 5-to-1. So that gap in valuation metrics and multiples has only gotten larger. And it's even more so in the junior names, where there's complete investor apathy in these names. So the way that I think about it is, okay, well, if you're paying 7x cash flow for a blue chip, you're taking on the risk that multiple could compress and or commodity prices could come down. If you're buying a mid cap at 2x cash flow, the multiple can only compress so much more. You're still taking on commodity price risk, but you're buying things at a lot better value or valuation. Now, we've been saying this for a year, and the mid caps have continued to diverge in the valuation, which is interesting, because you could say, well, we were wrong, but it also makes an even better case to now invest in the mid caps. So as that valuation gap diverges, it makes an even more and more stronger case to invest in some of the mid caps going forward. So that's the one sector, subsector that's really being focused on. We're talking companies that are in the $1 billion EV range, have some sort of leverage on it. They have some asset retirement obligations. They have some drilling potential, and they have some growth. These are the companies that in a higher oil price cycle are the ones that are going to move the fastest and are really going to shine. So, okay, it depends on your commodity price outlook. If you think we stay where we are, is there a lot of exciting companies out there? Possibly, but you really are betting on multiple re-rating. If you are betting on a higher oil price, higher commodity price environment, then the mid-caps really make a lot of sense. Now, the junior names, there's junior names that are XYZ barrels right now. They're growing the number of barrels by 20, 30, 40, 60, 80% a year. And that does two things. It increases your top-line revenue, which then has a bigger impact on your bottom-line cash flow. But also, as you grow your barrels, your operating cost per barrel comes down. So if you're producing 500 barrels out of a field, you have your operating cost at X. Well, now you're producing 1,000 barrels out of the field, your operating cost comes down per barrel because there's so much fixed cost associated with that smaller amount of production out of a field. So you got a double whammy effect of not just getting higher barrels, and so your top line revenue goes up, but your cash flow goes up by an even bigger margin because of your operating cost coming down. So there's a double whammy effect. And while we're here being patient for this cycle to come to us, if the company can grow production over a 12, 24, 36 month period and compound that production growth, well, then by the time the cycle comes, you're maybe 2, 3, 5X production And that's exactly how you want to go into the cycle with that higher production rate. And potentially delineation. You've not just increased production, you've delineated your property such that the rest of the wells are more cookie cutter than they were a couple of years ago. So I think those are the two sort of best ways to play this. Is you have your mid caps that are trading at much cheaper multiples than the blue chips, and then you have your junior companies that are actually increasing value and proving out a business plan while the cycle comes to them. There's varying amounts of risk here. If you think oil is going to be $60 a barrel and you're sort of underwriting that as your low end scenario, I've said this many times before, but that's not a scenario that you should be in anywhere in the oil and gas industry. So if you think that's your cycle, sort of low point or your base case, this industry is just not for you. There's way better other sectors out there that are gonna fit a portfolio. So really, you got to have a conservative but also optimistic outlook on where things are going, and then allocate your portfolio accordingly, depending on the amount of sort of risk you want to take. And really, I come back to the same point, I think, in almost every podcast, is if you think a smaller company is more risk, ask yourself, is buying something at 7x cash flow more risk, or is buying something at 2x cash flow more risk? And I think you can get to the answer that how a mid-cap or a junior company may not necessarily be more risky, despite the common thinking being that the smaller the company, the more risk it is. It's not necessarily as simple as that. And it may actually be a completely incorrect assumption to be making in the commodity sector at this point, given the large divergence between the large caps, the mid caps, and then the junior names.
Got it. Would you, next question, follow up. Let's say you're optimistic about the price of oil. Moving forward or right now, would you even touch exploration, or would you just want to be investing in just companies with proven reserves and proven cash flow? And the reason I ask that, it is somewhat of a dangerous time, but let's say you're optimistic and you want maximum torque, you know, you really want to leverage yourself up, and that would be an exploration company. Is that something you would touch now?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the investor's appetite. So I personally would say that while things are trading at such cheap cash flow multiples for operating assets, where you have infrastructure, you have land, you have mineral rights, you have the wells already drilled, you have production, you have cash flow today, it makes sense to buy more of a cash flowing E&P operating company. That being said, we're in a new era. There's a lot of technologies. There is a lot of land packages and drilling that could not be really worth spending time on or worth spending money on in a $50 oil environment. From 2015 to 2020, 6 years, we averaged $50 a barrel. So this new technology never really got used in certain parts of the North American oil fields. So now that we're at a $70, $75, $80 oil environment, some of that technology is being used. So if you see an exploration play, that's not just one well or two wells. It's actually trying to delineate a whole pool. Those sorts of packages might actually be quite interesting. The straight up wildcatting exploration play, it may be worth spending some dollars on. But to be honest with you, when I can buy a cash flowing company at 2x cash flow, that's well supported. They've got growth potential, they've got delineation, they've got water floods, they've got the ability to accelerate capital if need be. Why deal with that risk? I think the risk is just way too high. And you're not really getting your skewed risk reward. You're not getting your dollars worth of actual impact coming back to you. And I think that's going to stay, my opinion is going to stay this way until we hit 5, 6, 7x cash flow on some of these mid caps. And then, okay, now it makes sense to go and do some of these exploration plays. The one caveat I will say is if you're investing in blue chip companies that are 5, 6, 7, 800,000 BOEs per day, that are really not growing at all, well, maybe it makes sense now to go and take a little bit of flyer on some of these exploration plays and, just have a higher torque portfolio to that. But again, this is not investment advice. This is just how I see this. Why there's such a big gap you know, why not move from your large caps into your mid caps and into your juniors rather than go into an exploration play? So I think there's a market for everybody out there right now. There's some very interesting startup companies. There's some very interesting mid caps. There's some companies that are paying dividends, some that aren't, some are doing buybacks, some aren't, some are doing a growth play, some aren't. And you really get to pick and choose what exactly you want in your portfolio. And I love that because for a large part, the sector was indistinguishable. You had all these companies that did the exact same thing. And there's still a lot of companies that do the exact same thing and have the exact same business plan. Well, what differentiates them? Nothing. And it's nice to have some variety at least. And also, there's not that many companies left. So you're not picking between 400 companies. You're picking between 60 companies. So right. There's a lot better ability to focus on a certain name or really find the one you're looking for quickly rather than having to spend weeks and months scouring through these hundreds of companies to find the one that's exactly fits what you're looking for.
Got it. Let's talk about natural gas. There is a thesis out. Well, Russian-Ukrainian war conflict, whatever you want to call it, natural gas was going to be, you know, at a permanently high plateau, if you would. I know we here domestically has exported a tremendous amount of liquid natural gas over to Europe, and that really took a lot of that pain, if you would, over there off, and it was good for our companies. Not to say that war is good, but I hope you understand what I'm saying. But natural gas has really collapsed in the past several months or a few months. We had a bounce in, I want to say, October-ish, but now we're back down, I want to say, around the $2 range. So would you be an investor in natural gas, or is there just too much of it?
So obviously the widow maker commodity, I think anything in the power gen space is just so fascinating because everything has a point at which it can be replaced. So unlike oil, where, well, you can't put coal into your gas tank and run your vehicle. But you can replace your natural gas fired unit with a coal powered unit or a nuclear unit or a windmill or a solar, et cetera, et cetera. So there's always a substitution impact that comes into play. And what is everything else worth? So you know, right now, one could argue that we are in a slight oversupply of natural gas domestically in the US. That being said, the demand for natural gas continues to go up in the US with some of the retiring of the coal plants, and also just with increased demand in general for natural gas across industry and residential and commercial. But at the same time, we have our never-ending problem, which is that the natural gas growth of supply is not coming from pure natural gas wells. It's coming from the associated gas production out of the oil wells.
Right.
And as the Permian degrades, as the Bakken and the Eagle Ford degrades, you're going to see two things. You're going to see the current gas-oil ratio rise because the wells are just getting older. But also, as you start drilling into more fringe areas, you're just going to see more of a natural gas production per barrel of oil production. And that's just the nature of how a field is developed. You're going to drill your highest oil percentage wells first, and then you're going to go into your slightly lower oil percentage wells. So I think we're going to see continued growth in associated gas production in the U.S. This is also true because there's more pipelines coming on in the Permian. So there's about 2 BCF per day of capacity added in Q4 of 2023. That, of course, has also increased oil production slightly because it's created more room for the natural gas to flow. But also, you're literally producing more natural gas. So the Permian is, one could argue, overpiped on oil takeaway capacity, but it's underpiped still on the natural gas takeaway capacity. And there's continues to be more and more natural gas pipelines being built out of the Permian, and that's all associated gas. So they want that oil barrel. So they don't even really care what the gas BOE is worth. They just need to get it out of the way so they can produce the oil barrel, and they'll just keep producing it. So historically, that rate has been about 3 to 4 BCF per year that associated gas has grown. Well, with some of the slowdown in the Permian oil growth rate, it'll be interesting to see what the associated gas growth rate is. But I think never count these commodities out. These natural gas, coal, uranium, wind, electricity pricing. these commodities can fluctuate wildly in a very, very short period of time, and they can move up very fast. So it doesn't take very much of a shortage to go and push this thing up. And I would argue it's only 2, 3, 4 BCF per day of supply that has to come off, offline, or 2, 3, 4 BCF per day of extra additional demand that comes online. And over a few month period, that could really skew the balances majorly to the downside in terms of the storage present. And lo and behold, now going into summer, you have a very low storage. So people may be willing to make bets on where things are going. But really, the big win would be if the U.S. natural gas inventory starts to decline into the late winter, and now we still have winter and we have very little natural gas. Well, now that market is going to get bid up pretty significantly. And that's where we make a lot of our money. These markets move very, very fast. We saw this with the TTF spike in 2022, and also with some of the natural gas spike in North America in 2022. These markets can be very, very finicky. And all it takes is 1, 2, 3 BCF, and you're off to the races on that. So right now we're weak. But again, we're not drilling natural gas wells more and more and more. It's just the associated gas production continues to rise. And what's going to happen going forward? We can't just assume that the Permian associated gas is going to grow 2 to 4 BCF a year. That's just a false trend line to just keep following. What it looks like, the production rate has stalled, and it's going to further stall going forward. And that's going to be one of the big stories of 2024 is what happens with the U.S. shale production, and what happens with the Permian production, particularly given that a lot of the growth in 2023 came from the Gulf of Mexico, the Bakken and the Eagle Ford, and then some of the other Utah, Ohio, Oklahoma, Wyoming, etc. Areas.
Well, Shubham, I want to thank you so much for your time. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that? What's your Twitter or your X account? And give us your website.
Yeah, you betcha. So I'm most active on Twitter at WhiteTundraSG. So at the rate WhiteTundraSG. The website is whitetundra.ca. My personal email is on there, as well as a contact us form. So you can shoot me an email and we can have a discussion on that. And then the YouTube is also at WhiteTundraSG. I have all my archived seminars and the previous podcasts on my website as well, along with on the YouTube. So you can have a look at all the discussions we've had in the past. And those really are the best ways to contact me. I'm not really trying to go into any other platforms at the moment. These keep me busy enough at the time busy enough and connected enough that I don't need anything else.
And he's very responsive. He's been very responsive to me. So, well, I just want to thank you so much for your time. And we'll check in again here in the next few months.
Right on. Cheers.
Thank you.